I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
I don't say this much in meetings because people like to argue about it, but I say it from the podium. I'm a recovered alcoholic. What I've recovered is physical, mental, and spiritual health. What I've recovered from is a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I'm going to fiddle with this thing until it falls over.
Are you married?
No, I'm not. What I never recover from is what alcohol does to me when I take that first drink. The action of alcohol that causes the phenomenon of craving, that allergy is what differentiates me from a normal drinker.
Do you drink? Alcohol.
And I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is divinely inspired. It was started by a broken-down, unemployed stockbroker and a drunk proctologist. That's not divine inspiration. I don't know what is. But as a matter of fact, Dr. Bob, before he got sober, he went to get the oil changed in his car. And when they got done, he walked up to the counter and reached in his pocket for a pen to sign the receipt. Well, when he reached in his pocket, he pulled out a rectal thermometer. He goes, "Oh, my God." They said, "What's wrong?" He goes, "Some asshole's got my pen." And that joke's not for you. That joke's for me. It's to put me at ease. I was born in Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta. I grew up in Gwinnett County in a little small town that didn't have a stoplight till I was like 10 years old. Everybody knew everybody else's business. That wasn't a good thing in my case. And I'm the youngest of five. So I've got two sisters and two brothers. I've got a sister that's been sober since 1990. And my sobriety date is March the 6th, 1986.
You're married!
No.
Sorry.
Some of the earliest memories I can have is feeling different from other people. I was the class clown. I know you find that hard to believe, those of you that know me. But if somebody dared something to be done, all they had to do was dare me, and it was pretty much done. I didn't have that filter that a lot of people are born with. My older brothers taught me all the words I wasn't supposed to know. And I mean, I got sent home from school the first day of the first grade. Some of my earlier memories are of walking out in the yard and seeing my brother turn in the driveway doing about 90 miles an hour sideways, and I look and there's a cop car behind him. And that cop car rolling like end over end. And I told that story for years. And then I told it once in front of my mom to see if my memory was correct, and she's going, "Yeah, that really happened." So they knew I was coming years before I got there because I had older brothers that were always in trouble. And big news in town was somebody's horse got out or something like that, you know. I mean, everybody knew the name of everybody else's dog. And I just never did really feel like I fit in. And I played sports. I played football for 5 years. I played soccer for 5 years. And I wasn't very good at either one of them, but I participated. And The first drink I ever remember having, I was 8 years old, and my dad was having a business meeting with a guy. He installed underground lawn sprinkler systems like Three Rivers and Atlanta Stadium and some of those jobs. He was having a meeting with a guy in the kitchen, and he said, "Get me a beer," and I reached in the refrigerator and got him a PBR. Ugh. And I said, "Can I have a sip?" And he said, "Sure." And I opened it up and went on about my business and brought it back to him empty a few minutes later. And he just kind of laughed and got his own beer. Mm-hmm. And but my sister tells me when I was a baby, they gave me alcohol to make me sleep through the night, so I wouldn't be crying and disturbing them. And that's just, you know, the way it was in the 60s. It was a lot different than it is today. The first time I ever remember getting drunk, I was at a wedding and I was 12 years old. And after the wedding, I was part of the crew that helped clean up. And at 12 years of age, I couldn't stand to see somebody drink half a drink and leave it. So all the half drinks that were left, I drank them. And I got pretty loaded. And I was the life of the party. Everybody thought it was funny because, you know, it was a different time then. I'm glad that I pulled most of my crap before cell phones and videos and all that kind of stuff. Because I'd probably have my own YouTube channel or something. Oh. When I was 15, I started experimenting with other things. And I'm going to date myself. There used to be a cereal commercial. And it was about this guy named Mikey, and they'd go, "Mikey likes it, give it to Mikey, Mikey likes it." I was the Mikey of the drug trade. If they had something new that came out, they gave it to me. And they saw whether or not it worked. Sorry, my story includes some drugs, but I try to keep it to a minimum with respect to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught early on to respect the language of the fellowship I attend, and I try to do that, but my story is my story. So, I got into a lot of other drugs, and especially in the summertime after school was out, but yeah, I like to go to school to meet up with people to get loaded with, you know, because I lived on 40 acres, and we didn't have any neighbors or anything, so I really didn't have people my age to relate to or to play with or anything like that. So I enjoyed going to school. I didn't enjoy doing the work. I was the one that would come in on Thursday after not, you know, like it says in the big book, I came to work on a Tuesday morning. I came to school on a Thursday morning. Got the test reviews and aced the test on Friday and flunked the class because I wasn't doing any homework and I wasn't doing anything Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. That's pretty much my story. And in high school, I got suspended like 7 times for fighting fireworks and drugs 3 times. And the last time I got suspended, and I told this story at NAVA one time, and this girl told me where I went to school. She remembered the incident. They suspended me and told me to go home, and I went home and got one of my dad's work trucks that had these big motors on it. And I went all through the back lawn, and I was throwing gravel and mud and dirt in the classrooms. So they told me, don't ever come back to any campus in Gwinnett County ever again. About 10 years ago, I went back for a kind of a class reunion. They were all going to a football game on Friday night. And I was a little bit nervous about the because I saw a guy in the paper getting accolades the other day that was the guy that kicked me out of school. He's been an educator for over 50 years. And he probably remembers me. I don't know how much ego that is. But
do you have children?
You know. I never was good at following directions. After all else fails, read the directions was my motto. Alcoholics in general aren't good at following directions. I give you an example. These guys were in this halfway house and they had to walk past this mental health center every day to go to a meeting. And this is going to sound familiar to you, Bob. The director of the halfway house told them, whatever you do, steer clear of that mental health center. Those guys are trouble. So they were walking past there one day, and this guy heard people in the fence chanting, 13, 13. So he looked through the hole in the fence. Somebody poked him in the eye with a stick, and they started chanting, 14. So we're not really good about following directions. I took a lot of hallucinogens and a lot of things that keep you up for days at a time, and I remember my dad busted me one time, and we had this altercation. I had been up for days, and they were doing some construction across the street. And I went running across the street and got on this bulldozer. I was going to knock the house down. But I couldn't figure out how to crank that bulldozer. So I just had to walk it off.
How many children do you have?
They started looking. None that I know of. They started looking for a place for me to go. And I was so paranoid living on that 40 acres, hearing all the crickets and the tree frogs and crap. I just knew there were people out there spying on me. I'd look out the window and I'd know there were people looking back. Bridgeview was full. They didn't have a bed for a week, and they checked a few places out. And I landed in a place called Bronner's. It's not there anymore. It was over on Atlanta Road. And they dropped me off there. And I thought I was in a government protection place to protect me from all the gangsters that were out to get me. There weren't really any gangsters out to get me. I know that is part of some people's story. It's not really part of mine. They were all in my head. As a matter of fact, let me back up a little bit. The year I got kicked out of high school, I went to work for my brother in Texas framing houses. I was still pretty paranoid. People were out to get us, and he sent me off to the store one day, and I got lost, and I just got on Interstate 10 and started driving. I thought all these gangsters are closing in on me, and I'm going to cheat them out of the thrill of getting me. My story includes some mental illness. So what I did when I was about out of gas is I ran into a bridge abutment doing 55 miles an hour. I remember waking up and seeing some compound fractures and kind of passing out and waking up with the fire department using the jaws of life prying me out. And when I was in the hospital, they were giving me liquid Demerol every 4 hours, and they didn't have those machines where you gave yourself your own shot. They did it manually. And I had the clock. I was timing them every 4 hours, and I guess I was off by an hour, and they said they couldn't give me a shot. And I got mad, and I reached over and hit this cabinet, and I had a cast on my hand where I had broken it, and my fingers kind of came out of it sideways, and I didn't even know because I was on Demerol. And, you know, I was in traction. I spent 30 days in bed, and if you've ever been off your feet for that long, you lose your sense of balance. It's hard the first couple times you get up to walk. And I talked this nurse into bringing me some pot, and I told her I wouldn't smoke it until I left the hospital. And when she left, I got up out of that bed and went in the bathroom and smoked it all. And the nurses were coming in the room, highly peeved. And one of them called the cops, thankfully. But the physical therapist came in the next day and said, "Well, smells like you're ready to go." And I said, "I am." And I hopped up and I walked so far they had to put me in a wheelchair to bring me back. But I say that to point out that alcohol and other things were the center point of my life. Everything revolved around them. The getting, the using, I planned my life around that. I planned my jobs around that. I had jobs where they didn't drug test you or anything. And after couple months in that hospital, I came home, and I was at my parents' house, and these guys were bringing me drugs and alcohol, and I had a cup of Bacardi 151, and we had a Bunsen burner over here for all the pot we were lighting, just so we wouldn't have to spark the lighter every time, and I reached over for that glass of 151, and it turned over and it hit that Bunsen burner, and I'm in a wheelchair. And it started the rug on fire, and it made a spot about that big. That was pretty hard to explain. But you know, nothing hardly ever slowed me down. I got a job at a warehouse, and I would back trucks up for other people to load and unload. And I got a CDL and started driving all over the country. And I curbed my partying a little bit. But I did a lot of things that make you drive from coast to coast. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I weighed 149 pounds. I look like today, I look like I ate 149. Sobriety's been very good to me. I've grown in sobriety.
What's your weight now?
270. When I was in that treatment center, they brought in Alcoholics Anonymous from the outside. And the first thing I recognized was the look in people's eyes. What the hell? I don't want to talk to Siri. These phones, man. Smartphone, dumb user. Oh. Siri said, "I'm not sure I understand." I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But my first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous was them bringing meetings into that treatment center. And I saw a look in people's eyes like they had a peace and a serenity, and I wanted to know how they got that. They had a message that had depth and weight. That's experience and solution. That means when I talk to somebody new, they can tell I've had their experience. They can tell I'm coming at them from my own experience. When I continue to talk, they can see that I've found a solution. That's depth and weight. The people just had a look in their eyes like they were all right. And I wanted that. I wanted that peace of mind that I saw in them. And, this thing's recording me now. Oh well. My fault. They gave out white chips. And I didn't know anything about the chip system. I just knew every time somebody picked up a white chip, they clapped. Everybody clapped and cheered. So they offered a white chip. I went up there and got it. And every time they offered a white chip after that, I went up there and got it. I didn't know if you hadn't been drinking again, you don't need to pick up another one. I had to explain that to a guy the other day. It kind of took me back to that time. And after I got the fourth white chip, this woman, I overheard her saying to somebody, "What is that asshole doing?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "If you're not still drinking, you don't need another white chip. You pick up a white chip when you want to stop drinking." And I said, "Okay." So every time they gave out a white chip after that, I walked up and gave one back. This is not the program, this is my program. Until I was left with one white chip. So I can't in full honesty say I've only picked up one white chip. But I can say I haven't had a drink since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that I'm grateful. And it's not by virtue, it's by necessity. This was the last house on the block for me. I've been to the Funny Farm a few times, which I didn't talk about. You know the story. Given a choice between being crazy or giving up alcohol and drugs, I chose crazy because I could still have my alcohol and drugs. You know, and I used to say, and I'm dating myself, some people will recognize this, I used to say, I wasn't on my way to GMHI, I was on my way to JAIL. I didn't come from Penn State, I came from State Penn. And I wish I could say I haven't been to jail since I stopped drinking. I won't say since I've been sober, because some of the stuff I was doing was not really sober behavior. When I left treatment, I got in this halfway house on the south side called Mar, and they had apartments in Riverdale at the time. And I had a girlfriend, and that was against the rules. And we had a house meeting, and I didn't get along with the people in that house, and they didn't get along with me. It was a mutual dislike. And I was on the hot seat a lot because I was the new guy and easy to point the finger at. But that night, they said, "You've been he-ing and she-ing, when can you leave?" So I jumped up and said, "How about right now?" And they said, "Whoa, sit down a minute, we need to talk some more." And what they said was, those people that I disliked, that we had a mutual dislike, told me, "I don't have to drink over any of that stuff." And I took that to heart. It was the first time I had been exposed to unconditional love of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I appreciated them sharing that with me. So I got out of there and I went to a halfway house up near Nava where I started going to meetings when I had 3 months. And I will say I got my first sponsor. I had a sponsor in treatment. I never used him. The first time I got off all the restrictions where I could use the phones, I called him up and laid out my problems to him. And he said, "Why don't you pray about that?" And I said, "I think I'll do that." And I never called him back. And fast forward about 12 years, I'm sitting at this lunchtime meeting in Norcross, and I look across the table, and there he is, still sober. And I was still sober. He was sober because he was sponsoring people and working the program. And I was sober because I was doing the same thing. And when I got to Nava, there was a guy that had about 10 years. And when he opened his mouth, he sounded like a genius. I mean, he had some profound stuff to say. And little did I know, it was mostly coming out of the big book. If I read it, I might have known that. He took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it changed my life. But shortly after that, I won't say after sobriety, I'll say after sobriety. Because what I'm fixing to tell you is not sober behavior, but I lost my driver's license after I got sober. And I kept getting busted driving without a license, so I bought a motorcycle. I figured, I got this down. I got this. I had arrived, you know. And every time a cop got anywhere near me or gave me a funny look, I just hauled ass. Until one day, we're sitting over there in traffic on Buford Highway, and they got me cornered and reeled me in. And I got a DeKalb County judge as my lawyer in DeKalb County. He played golf with all the other judges, and it was the best $1,000 I ever spent. Because I walked in that courtroom, and that solicitor said, "That's him. He's not going to quit driving. I want him to do 4.5 years. And BJ was my lawyer's name. He walked over there with a folder and opened it up and said, "I think he needs to go to boot camp." And they said, "Okay." And signed off, and I went to boot camp for like 104 days. And what it was a military-style alternative to prison. If you don't get it straight there, then the next stop is prison. And so I told my sponsor, "I'm going off to boot camp." And he said, "If that's where you're to carry the message, then so be it." And I was like, "Damn, man." So the first week I was there, they came to us on Friday. We got there on Monday, and they came to us on Friday, and they said, "We're not having a speaker meeting tonight because the speaker is ill." And I said, "I'll do it." So I stood in front of about 100 guys that could be less interested in my story than anybody I've ever heard, except a few of the hecklers. And they'd blurt out I was lying. And so I don't mind a little heckling. I'm kind of used to it. That was a tough place to tell my story. So I got out of there, and I quit driving for a year until I could get my license back and do everything the legal way. And I decided that you know, I was going to do things the right way and start practicing some principles. And I got my CDL back a few years later, and after a few years in the sign business, and I started hauling cars, and you know, the semis you see with cars stacked and packed all over them and hanging all off of them, it's an adventure. And I got to hit the road for a year or so and see the country again like I had in my 20s. And I really enjoyed it. I got to go to meetings all over the country, and I walked in a meeting in a place called Watertown, North Carolina. And I had to just about cut a hole in the smoke to see my way in the room. And when I walked in there, I looked around, and I was the only one in there with a full set of teeth. And I thought, damn, people sure are good looking where I go to meet. But when they opened up the meeting, they came out of the book, and it was real solution-oriented Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I'm thankful for the book. I can go anywhere and catch a good meeting and catch the solution and catch the message. And I forgot to tell you a little story about that judge that was in AA. He was the founder of my home group. And he started a group over in Decatur called the Belvedere Group. And when people got out of jail, he sentenced them to that group. And he was there making sure they were going. And this old timer came up to him and said, BJ, you can't do that. You can't force people to go to AA. It's a program of attraction, not promotion. And he goes, I just made them some bitches the most attractive offer they ever had. AA or jail? So I came up in Alcoholics Anonymous with some pretty good characters. The first time early on in my sobriety that I didn't have a bunch of drama going on and chaos, I called my sponsor and I said, I'm bored, man. And I gave him a graphic description of my condition. And he goes, sounds like serenity to me, and hung the phone up. I miss those old phones that when you slammed them down on somebody, you could hear that bell ring. Yeah, I miss sometimes, just not the same going, click. After a few months, I got out of that halfway house. But one night before I got out, they came to me and said, somebody's going to get kicked out for he-ing and she-ing tonight. I went, oh my God, not again. It wasn't me, it was another guy. I had a girlfriend in the halfway house, but this time it was another guy. And as we were going around the circle sharing experience, I was kind of the senior man in my house. They said, what do you think? I said, you don't have to use over any of this stuff. And it was the first time I got to share from personal experience. You know, before I decided to fly right, I had that motorcycle, and I went over to my parents' house, and I asked them for some money. They were holding some money for me, and I was in legal trouble, and I needed to go to court. And they said, have you been drinking? And I had 3 years without a drink at the time. And I was highly pissed. Never mind, I was acting like a drunk and doing the same things I did when I was drinking. I hopped on that motorcycle that I didn't have a license for, and I hauled ass over to the NABA club. And this guy goes, does anybody have something they want to talk about? And I raised my hand. I said, yeah, I do. I haven't had a drink in 3 years, and my parents don't trust me. Back in those days in AA, at this place anyway, the discussion leader walked around like Phil Donahue. He goes, how about you? You want to share? He walked over and stood in front of me and got right down in my face and goes, all I got to go on is your track record. And I wanted to knock him out. But it was the truth. But he offered some solution. He said, every day that you're staying sober, and practicing the principles, you're building a new track record. And I went to see my probation officer, and he laid the same stuff on me. He goes, have you been drinking? I ought to send your ass back to jail right now. And the thought crossed my mind, no, but before I go to jail, I will drink. And I got up, and he said, where are you going? I said, I need to go to a meeting. And I went to this meeting in the Biscayne Room, and they talked about putting conditions on your sobriety. And I can't put conditions on my sobriety. I have to be willing to stay sober under any conditions. The big book says if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. I'm going to the funeral tomorrow. I'm wearing this suit again. This is my all. This is my everything suit. So get a picture. You won't see me in it very often. But you know, life has trials and low spots. Most of the low spots have been of my own making. And you know, sometimes when I'm trying to help God out, I don't know the difference between interference and helping him out. You know, sometimes I gotta just let God do his thing. Do the prayer and the willingness and let God do his thing. Turn my thoughts to somebody else I can help. I like to talk about 10th step stuff. Damn, that's getting harder than it used to be.
Handsome, do you have children?
At least I didn't overeat this time. I spoke a few months ago at an eating meeting, and it was my first experience doing that. And I ate entirely too much food. Worked myself into a food coma. I look up, I got like 20 minutes till I have to speak. So I fired down 3 cups of coffee real quick to break me out of that food coma, and I stood up there with jitters. Yeah. I brought some enthusiasm. You know, when people want to argue about the recovered thing, I point them over to page 85 where it says, we are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I hear people say, just ignore that. It's on silent. It really is. I hear people say, what I have is a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual condition. That's not true. It's contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I get fearful from time to time. I get angry from time to time. I get resentful from time to time. I get that way. I can't afford to stay that way. Because these are some of the things that block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And when I went through the steps with my sponsor, we got down on our knees and did the 3rd step prayer. And when I stood up, he handed me the 4th step packet. And he explained to me how to work the columns from top to bottom and how to go through that inventory. And I sat on it for a long time. I wasn't willing to do it. I just didn't have the willingness to do that at the time. And it's a miracle I didn't drink. I fellowshipped. I hung out with a lot of people doing the deal. I try to work people through the steps quickly, even though that wasn't my experience. It's the way that I found is most effective for me, just for me, to work with others. I spent years trying to help people get sober, and 20 years of sobriety, nobody I ever sponsored got sober. And this guy traveled around the country doing sponsorship workshops, and he showed how to take people through the steps quickly. And the very next guy I talked to got sober. He's got one white chip, and July 4th he'll be picking up 11 years. And he's sponsoring people. And a fellowship began to grow up about me, and it added a new layer to my sobriety, a new enthusiasm for this thing. In a lot of meetings, I noticed here you read the 10 step promises. I like that. You stole some of my thunder. I talk about them too. You know, it says at the end of the 9th step promises, they will always materialize if we work for them. It says this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. I'm not waiting until nighttime to clean up my wreckage. I'm cleaning it up as it happens. We vigorously commenced this way of living, step 10, as we cleaned up the past, step 9. That means that once I've entered into the amends process and I've started making those amends, that I'm to move on to 10, 11, and 12, the daily living steps. If I wait until I'm done making my 9th step amends, I might not ever get to 10. You know? We've entered the world of the Spirit, Harry likes to say. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. It's not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Now in 6 and 7, I asked God to remove my defects of character. I became willing in 6, and I asked Him in 7. I believe I've still got every one of them I walked in here with. I'm not driven by them today. I don't have to act on them. I don't have to buy another motorcycle that I have no license to drive. The reason I know some of them hasn't been removed, because right here in 10 it says continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Not if, but when these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. If I take those steps on a daily basis, then when it's time to go to bed at night, when we retire at night, my review is short, sweet, and to the point. I answer those 7 questions, and I sleep well. I don't wait till nighttime to clean up my wreckage. I clean it up as it goes. Because when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Promptly is a lot shorter than it used to be. Promptly used to be like maybe a day and a half. Now it's like 5 minutes, man. The program starts working on me when I owe somebody an amends. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. That tells me that there's some positive in that review, too. It's not all about what have I done wrong. It's about, it can be about some things I've done right also. This guy brought me a form from his treatment center. And it had 144 emotions on it. And his job was to go over his day's events and attach one of those 144 emotions to it. And then try to go to sleep. Yeah. Now, I don't stir things up when it's bedtime. I do this short, sweet review from page 86, and I sleep well. But this is my daily living directions. It tells us what to do when we retire at night. It tells us what to do upon awakening. We think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. But before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, asking especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. So, the very first thing I do is ask God to direct my attention. If I make my plans, my glorious and grandiose plans for the day, before I ask God to direct my thinking, I'm operating on my will. I need to turn it over to God's will and then make my plans for the day. And even then, they're not set in stone. They're subject to change. I give myself a break if I fall short of what I plan to get done for a day. And that's different than it used to be. But it tells us what to do when we retire at night, upon awakening, what to do when we face indecision, what to do after. It says we usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we'd be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we'd be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. So it assumes we're in meditation, which I used to go to this meditation meeting at Triangle, and they would meditate for 10 minutes at the beginning of the meeting. And every week I would get in there and we'd meditate, and I'd be like, this is great stuff. I need to do this more often. And then I wouldn't do it, and the next week would roll around and I'd be in there going, this is great stuff. I need to do this more often. And eventually I began to incorporate it in my days, and that helped greatly with anxiety and depression and stuff like that. Helped me a whole lot to meditate. I have some outside issues that I get outside help for, and that's what the book recommends to do. It also tells us what to do when agitated or doubtful. We pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought of our thought or action. So aligning my will with God's will is proper use of the will. And then there's a whole chapter on step 12. It says 52 times in the book, working with others. They must have thought it was pretty important. Like the prayers. There's a prayer on anger, a prayer on fear. There's a prayer on resentment. There's three prayers about sex. They must have thought we were going to have a problem there. You know, they just told me that I don't ever have to be alone again. Anytime I've ever put my hand out, the hand of AA was there. And I got good news for you. I finish early or on time. I got one story I'm going to tell and wrap it up. 2 weeks after my first birthday in AA, the love of my life left me. And I was crushed, man. And one night, my roommates were gone, and the thought crossed my mind. I act when I have those kind of thoughts. I take action. I'm glad there's not a bottle in the house I'd be drinking right now. And I called my sponsor, and he said, quit effing around and start writing. And I stayed up all night and did my four step. And he was busy with some service work the next day, so I took it down to the Triangle Club. I went to the men's meeting, and I walked in. I said, I need to do a fist step with somebody. I've been thinking about drinking. And this old, crusty old fart walked up and goes, if you're thinking about drinking, why don't you just go drink? And I said, there's a difference between a thought and a desire. And it was just a thought, and I want to act before it becomes a desire. And this guy volunteered to hear my fifth step, and I went over to his house after the meeting, and I did my fifth step with him. And I wouldn't know him if he was sitting in here today. I just know that I put the hand out, and the hand of AA was there. You don't ever have to go through anything alone again. The only time I've ever gone through something alone was when I chose to, not when I had to. Because, like I say, when I put my hand out, the hand of AA was there. But it wasn't always the first hand that I reached out to. I have a list of people that I call today. And people that call me on my crap. They don't let me get away with stuff. Sometimes when people know that I've got like 32 years in the program, they let me slide on some stuff, and that's not good for me. I have people with less time that call me on my stuff. It doesn't matter to me. If you're doing the deal, you're doing the deal. I'll say this and be done. Sometimes I hear people complain about the quality of meetings at some places, and I usually say, why don't you go there and make a difference? Harry's sponsor, a guy named Bill R., a meeting could be going to hell. I mean, just horrible. And they would turn to him, and he would share, and the whole course of the meeting changed and became a solution-oriented meeting. And I'm like, I want to be like that guy. There was a girl at NABA one day that was an exotic dancer, and she liked to throw that out there. And we were in this 1:30 meeting, and they were shaming her about it. You're going to get drunk. You can't do that and stay sober. And everybody looked over at Bill, and Bill said, we don't care what you do for a living. We just want to love you till you learn to love yourself. And that ended that shame fest, you know? And Milton Crabapple had a son that was in the oil industry. And he went to South America. And when he went to South America, for one Christmas, he mailed him back an exotic bird, that thing about this big, macaw. You know it, don't you? He called him a couple weeks later, and he said, Dad, how'd you like that bird? And he said, oh, we love that bird, son. He was delicious. He said, oh, my God, I can't believe you ate that bird. That bird cost a fortune. He spoke two languages. The guy goes, maybe he should have said something. So when the meeting's turning to crap, as a recovered alcoholic, it's my job to say something. That's all I can. All right.